Welcome to the official Georgia Public Broadcasting Signy Die edition of Political Rewind. It's 3:06 in the afternoon. We're live in the Midtown studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting today. And I will tell you, the legislature ended, about 12:20, I think, last night, somewhere in that neighborhood. And there are some people sitting around the studio who are really tired but are still here and at least appear to be somewhat coherent. So we'll find out as the show goes on today. We do have a lot to talk about in terms of the final hours of the session, as well as assessing what the session overall tells us about who we are as a people in the state of Georgia. Joining me, political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Jim Galloway. Also from the AJC, Kyle Wingfield. Both of them have two columns a week that appear on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and you can read them both online. Jim Galloway, of course, oversees Political Insider, the blog that's online every day. Also, State Senator Nan Orrick, Democrat from Atlanta. We're very happy to have you here. Thank you for being with us, Senator. And Brian Robinson, former Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for Nathan Deal, now a public affairs. What's the final word there, Brian? Public affairs blank.
Communicator.
Expert.
Expert.
Communicator.
Yeah, strategist. Guru.
When we don't have such pressing matters, we're going to find out what it means to be a public affairs guru. I'm not quite sure.
My parents want to know, too.
All right. So a lot happened last night. Let's just go down some of the bills that came down to the final hours and minutes of the session. The one that stands out that we might want to begin with, Jim Galloway, rape kits. It had a tortured path to finally being passed.
Tortured path. You had it passed unanimously in the House. Now, this would require hospitals, police, to pick up rape kits from hospitals. Within, I think, 96 hours of the time that the rape victims are examined. And we had 1,500 found in Grady that were backlogged. Dozens were found elsewhere across the state. It was a pretty serious problem picked up by Scott Holcomb, a Democrat from Atlanta, in the House. It passed unanimously, had everybody supporting it, ran into a brick wall in the form of Renee Unnerman, who's chairs the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, and she said it wasn't going to go anywhere. So they had to do an end run around her, and it took until the very last hours of the session. There was some intense discussion between Renee Unnerman, who is one of the only two Republican senators there, and Jan Jones, the House Speaker pro tem.
Yeah, it eventually did not have to pass through a committee because the House sent back over to the Senate a different iteration of the bill. Nan Orrick, what was going on? What was that all about? Renee Unnerman, eventually had to vote for the measure when it came to the floor.
Well, Senator Unnerman actually carried it on the floor and did an amendment that made some significant some pluses to the bill that had been talked about earlier, such as signing a waiver when you're getting that evidence collected, and
what does that
victim's
mean? Signing
rights,
a waiver,
victims' rights that the victim has the control over what happens to the evidence, and also that victims' rights, victims' bill of rights, is basically part of the material that is presented to everyone who is having that examination done and having that evidence for criminal prosecution collected.
Well,
so she amended that bill, actually gave it a name more to her liking, and the bill came back to the House and was immediately accepted with those changes. So there were lots of conversations going on throughout that day. And I think we came out with a win-win. And the chair lady, who has a long history of working on issues of assault and trafficking and victimization of women, is in the mix with that bill now, and we're happy for that.
So, Kyle, was this an example? We gave Renee Utterman on this show Wednesday. You weren't part of it, but people on this panel were pretty critical of her holding this thing up. Although we did also point out that quite often she's been a champion for especially women's rights. But was this, at least as it came to be, kind of the example of the worst of what can happen in the politics of the session?
Well, in some ways, yeah. I mean, in terms of someone deciding on their own that they're going to hold something up that has such wide support. And frankly, on the flip side, with some of the demonization of her that I saw, you know, on social media and on mass media.
Yeah, Samantha Bee went after her hard on that late night show that she does.
Full frontal.
Right. There are times when someone has a reason that they want to hold something up and they want to make some improvements. This was not an issue I followed the most closely.
Okay.
I did have a sense that it was probably going to work out in the end. But yeah, no, it was an ugly episode.
Brian, everything worked out.
That's right. I'm a big fan of ugly politics normally. You know, I'm usually behind the ugly politics.
A true confessions here.
Yeah, absolutely.
We thought full frontal was the
I think you see a lot of posturing throughout a 40-day session, and people are able to say they're against something when knowing full well they're going to have a compromise in the end. There's a lot of horse trading, and so I'm not always convinced when somebody says they're going to stand hard against something. Usually there's something they want that they're going to get from the House side, or they're going to get from another committee chairman in the Senate. At the end of the day, Renee Unterman did the right thing, as she almost always does. She's a great senator. She offers great perspective, not only as a female Republican, but as someone in the healthcare industry, and she showed once again that she's a leader.
One of the other things that we watched last night very carefully was to see whether any changes were going to be made in the campus carry bill, which passed both houses and went to the governor for his signature. But as most of you know who followed this legislation, the governor, after saying he liked the bill, he signaled he would support it or sign it. So, well, there are a couple of conditions that I'd like added. I'd love for you to look at it again. And Jim, we wondered yesterday whether, in fact, the people who were handling this measure, Rick Jaspers, Mandy Ballinger in the House, were they going to, in fact, find a way through a different gun bill, 1060, HB 1060, to add the governor's conditions, and they dug in.
The answer is no, of course. you had a general, what's called a cleanup gun bill, and the only major thing that was added to that was a measure sponsored by Jesse Stone, I believe, out of East Georgia, state senator, that prohibits banks from discriminating against loans to gun manufacturers or gun stores simply because they are gun manufacturers or gun stores.
Yeah,
I need that kind of protection.
Yeah, you know, Nan, we all kind of knew when we watched that bill being discussed, the amendment being discussed from the well of the House, and that was it, the bank measure. We kind of knew at that moment that everything the Speaker and Rick Jaspers had said was true. They were drawing a line in the sand. Now, the politics of that are kind of interesting, but what is it? Well, the governor's not getting those conditions, not having guns in campus child care centers.
That's right, and nor on campuses where there are high school students in attendance doing early college prep.
And some administrative control over where guns would be on a campus. What do you think the people of Georgia are exposed to as a result of those conditions not being put back into the bill?
Well, I think that the opportunity for the governor to veto that bill is on the rise. We delivered 30,000 petitions to him yesterday at the state capitol. You know, this is a real puzzler. You've got the polls showing 78% of Georgians don't want campus carry. 100% of campus police chiefs don't want campus carry. 100% of the university presidents and administrators don't want campus carry. Huge outcry from the faith community that don't want campus carry. And they go ahead with an agenda that very much is driven by a fringe group.
What fringe groups?
Well, you've got Kerry, Georgia. You've got the NRA, and you've got behind all of them, and back in the shadow, you've got the gun manufacturers.
Okay, but Kyle, I take Nan Oreck's point, I'm not sure the NRA certainly, and maybe Georgia Kerry, which is an offshoot of NRA here in Georgia.
They're a rival group. They're a rival group. They think NRA is soft.
But the NRA is not a fringe group.
No, it's got quite a large membership, yeah. I think.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Rather loose definition of fringe, I think.
88, 98. Well, say 22% of Georgians thought that might be a good idea or didn't weigh in against it in the polling that was done. So that's a tiny slice of the state population to go with.
Okay, so we're saying here, Nan Oreck is saying, Kyle, in the long run, the legislature is doing what they think. I assume they think their constituents want on this one, despite what the polling shows.
Despite what the regents want.
There's a generational thing going on here.
What's that?
I mean, if you're of a certain age, which is younger, far younger than me, you're worried about crime and all this sort of stuff that goes on some campuses. If you're my age or maybe older, you keep wondering what if those Kent State students had had guns?
Oh, okay.
Well, and I think the younger generation, to the extent they support this, is wondering what if those Georgia State students who were robbed in their own library had guns? I mean, the idea that, well, if this bill's vetoed, there won't be guns on campus, I think is, I don't think anyone actually believes that.
You
can have the argument over whether, you know, the good guys with guns versus the bad guys with guns.
That's quite a fundamental argument. Yeah.
I'm not dismissing it, but the idea that, well, we've been successful at keeping guns and gun violence off campus. I mean, just Georgia Tech, Georgia State. There's a number of examples where it's just simply not true.
And what can be done? And it's been shown in other states. They've come up with the numbers. It up in the millions of dollars that the people in charge of our security on campus tell us they will need in order to adapt their situation to dealing with guns on campus.
So
what we could do instead of passing a bill like that is you beef up campus security in places that are located in areas of high crime, like Georgia Tech or like Georgia State.
Help us, because you've worked with this governor specifically. He'll have the opportunity to sign or veto it. But it is true that the polling and the police across the state didn't want this bill.
And the educators, people that run the colleges.
So what is the impetus behind this overwhelming desire to pass this legislation? Is it as simple as Nan Oreck says, that there's powerful and well-funded lobbyists who are trying to get their measure through?
No, I do think that for those who voted for it, that it is a matter of principle. And I do think that the members who were pushing it believe that students will be safer if they are able to defend themselves. And on the political level, you know, you're talking about a Republican caucus that has no fear whatsoever of a Democratic challenge in November. They are facing only a Republican challenge in a primary, particularly, you know, same would be for Senator Oreck. She has, I could run against Senator Oreck. I can move
all day long.
And despite, you know, your party
label would make you unelectable in
exactly,
my district.
Despite my great merits as a public servant, she would thump me. So Republicans have that same issue. They have got very conservative electorates where being pro-gun on any level, being in any way in favor of a Second Amendment push is going to help them in that primary. So that's their calculation.
And I will tell you, there is some personal motivation here, too. You've got a number of legislators who are behind this who have college-age students, and those students are matriculating at Georgia State, at Georgia Tech, or on the AU campus.
So,
of course, the ludicrous thing, Bill, is that they say people with a license to carry a concealed weapon are the safest people walking on the street. And in fact, we do not have one demonstration of any competence with a weapon that has to be presented in order to get that license. There are states that hold concealed carry weapons. They issue them only to people that go through a training as extensive as law enforcement. We hand them out, you know, like paper towels in a restroom.
And now we also have tasers coming to campus.
Yeah, they passed the taser bill last night. Let's talk about that.
But wouldn't you rather be tased than shot? I mean,
Oh my gosh, the choices we're coming down to.
I'm only thinking of the frat parties.
Oh. Right. Yeah.
The taser bill was one of those bills that got came through at the last minute.
That's right.
It essentially gives you the right as a student to carry a taser.
Yeah, now there was a safety provision put in there. Originally, there was no age limit, but now they sent it back and worked it out so it's now to prevent high school students who wander on campus from carrying tasers. You have to be 18 years old to carry it.
Oh, gee, the height of good judgment.
All right, so, okay, so now I have a choice. Is that what we're saying here? I can carry a 38 or a little, smaller caliber pistol.
Exactly. This is an all of the above strategy.
Except no long rifles.
Yes. Or you can be composing your thank you letter to the governor for having the good sense to veto this bill.
All right. So, we'll talk about that in a minute. But so, is there more, Brian, that we're going to see next session? In other words, every time we think we've gotten pretty close, the pro-gun folks come back with more. What could be on the horizon next year?
Well, we knew the campus carry thing was coming back even when we passed Guns Everywhere back in 2014 because they wanted to pass this as part of that package back then. And Governor Deal was one of the people who stepped in during that and said, let's carve this out and deal with it later. So we knew that was coming. At this juncture, I don't know what's daycares maybe.
There's not a lot left, is there, Jim?
You can do it at churches or bars.
I think you go for higher caliber.
Well, you know, so many people across the state are absolutely appalled at this, and it's a judgment mark on the GOP leadership in their eyes. So I was at the home of a family who lost their daughter to violent gun death on Sunday. Dear friends, Aaron Watson, he's a public servant in Atlanta, has been on our city council, our school board. And the young woman's mother said, what are they thinking? How can they imagine, how can they possibly think that spreading guns out, putting more guns in the hands of more people is a good idea? Don't they understand all the downside of a gun culture that we've spawned? And she's saying that as she's preparing, her funeral for her daughter. And people are appalled, and our email boxes are filled. And this has been going on, it seems, endlessly in Georgia around what's the next push for the gun lobby.
All right. Well, but this is an example of how gerrymandering really makes a
bad policy.
It certainly creates stark differences among legislators in terms of policy. So if the polls do overwhelmingly or by some large percentage say people don't want guns, we're not looking that broken down by legislative district, obviously.
No. Everything is Georgia is ruled through the prism of a Republican primary.
Right. Exactly. All right.
They're very well put. I mean, that explains
all right.
a lot.
So it's a done deal. Campus carries on the governor's desk. What are the pressure? How much of a consideration do you think the governor's going to have to give to signing or not signing this bill? We know the regents don't like this bill. Hank Huckabee is his appointee, is chair of the Board of Regents. Is that a factor in what the governor does here?
I think you have to go bigger picture to think about that. You've got the religious freedom bill, which I'm sure we'll be talking about shortly, that is also definitely there's a huge push for vetoing that. But the governor has a measure on the ballot this fall, Opportunity School District. He has his big education reform package, which he didn't put forward this year, to come next year. This governor is not finished asking for things from some of the people who wanted things like campus carry and religious freedom. So I think to really get a picture, you have to step back and think, okay, in the big picture, what does this governor think he can do and still accomplish what he has left on his plate over the next couple of years.
Okay, Brian, you've worked with him. Is Kyle have the right take on what the governor's going to be thinking about?
Kyle is dead on, and it's something that you and I have talked about before. The governor's not done yet, and the votes he's going to depend on, with all due respect, are not from Dan Orrock. They're from the Republican caucus. And so keeping them on his side has been very important, will be as he goes through this bill signing period. Let's look historically at what Governor Gill has done. He has vetoed very, very little. He has been
pro-legislature.
Pro-legislature, yeah. What they sent to his desk for the most part.
Far less than Sonny Perdue, I think.
Far
less vetoing.
I mean, yeah.
Well, he's nowhere near as cranky as Sonny Perdue was. He gets along better,
You said it, not me. But I think Governor Perdue perhaps vetoed more in 1 year than Governor Deal has after five sessions. So this could show a change of the culture there. And part of that is just a natural progression. First-term governors with a partisan majority in the legislature are going to get a lot of deference because the legislators want to see a Republican governor get reelected. In a second term, all bets are off, and the sharks are out. He no longer gets that deference. He can't say, don't put this on my desk, you're putting me in a bad political situation. They don't care anymore if they put him in a bad political situation. So he's going to have to swallow more bad stuff to keep those relationships up. He's in a tough spot. I would not want to be in his shoes right now because I agree with Senator Orrock that campus carry is not popular with a majority of Georgia voters, but it is with a majority of Georgia Republicans. And that's a very difficult balance for him.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple other bills quickly. Let me just say the medical marijuana, which had already been stripped of the provision that most people cared most about, which was limited production of cannabis oil in the state. The governor had already said no to that, and so it came out early in the session. But even the adding of, 9-8 conditions that would be treatable by medical marijuana went down last night.
It was on our desk, and it never got taken up.
I think there was a concurrent provision in the amendment to lower the THC count
to 3%,
from 5 to 3%, yeah. Which was also that was a deal killer as well.
Mm-hmm.
And why was that a deal killer? We wanted to keep the THC.
It weakened what the legislature did last year.
Okay.
The amendment that was on our desk actually weakened.
Well, the speaker said here the other night when Jim and I interviewed him for Lawmakers that he thinks the most important thing is that limited production, and he made it clear that it's coming back next year.
Yeah.
We're not going to duck this for much longer, right?
I would agree.
All right, finally, let's talk. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. It's already almost 3:30, so let's get a break out of the way, and let's come back and talk about this strange introduction last night of a measure that to many people seem to be, from the pro-religious liberty folks, a shot across the bow at the corporate interests that have been lobbying against it, and sort of a threat at what could happen down the road if they don't back off. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 3:29. We'll be back in just about 30 seconds.
Yeah, that one was a lot of fun.
A revolution is happening. Cable companies are unbundling. They're offering fewer channels, and some viewers are losing their favorites.
It's nice to sit and watch something about farming and something that you really love, like animals, instead of those goofy Real Housewives.
The changing business of television, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to the official Sine Die edition of Political Rewind. Kyle Wingfield, Senator Nan Orrick, Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway in the studio today. Let's talk about this really strange measure that popped up last night. We all know the Religious Liberty Bill, which some people find to be perfectly strong, fine legislation protecting the religious interests of the faithful. Others say is the door to discrimination is on the governor's desk. Jim, what happened last night?
Okay, this is about what, 7 o'clock, Kyle?
Right after the dinner break.
Right, yeah. right after the dinner break, we have a bill pop up, a conference committee on a bill pop up. The bill is HB 904. I think it's a labor department bill that has nothing, but it opens the right code section, and suddenly we have a consumer, a Republican consumer protection bill that says that okay. If you're a corporation in Georgia and you are offer more anti-discrimination protections than is allowed by the federal government or by the state government, specifically LGBT,
which
means LGBT protections, then any lawsuit challenging your administration of those policies is subject to being declared a class action suit, which Republicans are historically
traditional GOP principle, right?
Yeah.
More class action lawsuits.
In other words,
trial lawyers.
In other words, it was an attempt to hoist the business community by its own petard. For their opposition to the religious liberty bills.
And it was even more clever than that, because those companies that chose to drop their policies to avoid lawsuits would, of course, be dropping non-discrimination policies for LGBT individuals. I mean, it was the ultimate double barrel.
It's a little. It was a
shot.
Machiavellian little ploy that certain senators have been talking about doing for. This is the third year.
Well, wait, was it Machiavellian or was it just plain an attack on corporations out there? If you don't back off on pressuring the governor on religious liberty, this is what we're going to do to you. We're going to open you up to class action lawsuits.
Yeah, and these guys are the bearer of Republican principle. They're the enforcers. They're the ones who call out the rhinos and the people who don't toe the line on all conservative dogma, and here they are proposing something that is anti-job, that is anti-business, that is pro-trial lawyer, that is pro-frivolous lawsuits. It goes against everything they say that they are for. And how people who signed on to that conference committee report expect to ever go into the business community and raise money for their campaigns, and some of those guys on that conference committee have statewide ambitions, is beyond me, because they're going to get laughed out of boardrooms after putting this forward. This was too clever by half.
Oh, sure.
It had tremendous blowback immediately, and it's in a really bad message.
And they
we should also say that it died.
It died. Yes. I was just saying.
There was yet another conference committee report placed on our desk for House Bill 904,
which was a first in my experience. I've never seen two conference committee reports from the same conference committee.
Dissolve a conference committee and reappoint it.
All right.
But they were quite smug about it and trying to shop it to the Democrats. We know you all are going to vote for this because you love class action suits and you hate discrimination.
Yeah, Senator Greg Kirk, who is the author of the First Amendment Defense Act, was on Lawmakers Live at about 10 after 7 from the Capitol last night. And he did have a little grin on his face when he talked to us, saying, oh, we've got something cooking. Wait till you see what we've got coming now. He refused to say what it was. We had to wait for the AJC to break the story a little while later, and then found out about it. But you're right, there did seem to be this sort of gleeful, we're going to get back at you.
And the funny thing is that we told them ad nauseum from the well, when you pass this this religious discrimination bill, you are going to hear from businesses, not only here, but all across the country. You're going to harm our economy if you go through with this. And once it started coming in, the bad news from the NFL and from Disney,
Hollywood Studios.
Once the bad news starts coming in, what are they? Remorseful? No.
Yeah.
They're PO'd.
All right. So, and that is the big question on the table right now. Governor Deal has the religious liberty bill as it had been formulated and passed without this stuff that happened last night. He's got to make a decision whether he's going to sign it or not. Kyle, what time did the governor come upstairs last? Do you know about what time it was?
It was 11. 9-ish.
All right.
Something
was it
like
that early?
That.
Was it that early?
It was earlier than usual, and it was we were joking in the press gallery, you could have fit the entire address in a tweet. It was basically shorter. Good job, everybody. I hope you're going to get reelected. See you next year.
Yeah, we should point out
pretty much it.
Governors traditionally do make an appearance on the close to signy die just to thank everybody for their hard work, right?
And they will wax eloquent about some highlights of the session, things that got done. That governor was not lingering over those.
Well, we can understand perhaps why Governor Deal is a little gun-shy, a little reluctant, given the major issues on his desk right now, to say too much. But he was cornered by reporters after he talked in the House and Senate. He didn't have Brian Robinson there to, you know, to fight off all of these reporters. You would have kept him far away if you'd still been there.
Lucky me, I was watching the Final Four.
So. All right, yeah. Let's hear what Governor Deal said. We're going to hear an exchange between Governor Deal about religious liberty, what he's going to do, and our good friend Doug Richards from 11 Live News.
It is a very difficult piece of legislation, and it's one that I am looking at very, very carefully.
Are you worried it will drive jobs out of Georgia or prevent folks from coming to Georgia who might have otherwise?
You know, I don't have any way to predict any of that, and I really don't want to comment any further on any of those implications of one way or the other.
All right. Governor Deal says he doesn't want to talk about it, Kyle. Where does this stand?
If I were a betting man, I would bet on a veto early next week.
I don't know that it's going to be early next week. You know, Governor Deal has traditionally, in the last four sessions anyway, taken about a week off after session. Let him recuperate. Let the staff recuperate. They've had long days too.
Sure.
If they do that, this will throw it over into April as a potential. But then again, he did say yesterday that he's going to be expeditious. But that means different things to different people. What I would like to see him do to Because this is a lose-lose for him. I mean, if he signs it, we deal with the national backlash like Indiana faced. If he vetoes it, then he has a problem with it with his own caucus and his own voters. So what I would like to see is him put together a veto and then an executive order that puts together a group of business people, LGBT community, people of faith, Republican authors of these bills, and say, you guys go into a room and come out with something that protects everybody's rights. It doesn't cause boycotts in Georgia.
The reason I don't think that'll work is because I think there are a lot of folks who have lost faith in the idea that those groups are ever going to come together and agree on something. I could imagine him vetoing it and saying, all right, I gave you guys your chance to do this. We've been talking about it for three sessions, and I've stayed relatively quiet about it. Here is exactly what I would sign. Pass it next year, and I'll sign it. Anything beyond that, you know, it'll get vetoed again.
Well, we have a U.S. senator from Georgia saying loudly and clearly, you don't need to pass anything.
Johnny Isaacson.
That's right.
Said, we got let the feds take care of this.
That's right. This is federal in nature. It's nationwide. It's a mistake for states to go down this road.
Jim Galloway, I want to pick up on something Brian said. Excuse me. The notion that the governor has to do something because he has an agenda he wants to deal with next year to accommodate his members in the legislature, the notion that he has to please voters out there, it strikes me that the governor can veto this measure. If I'm running for re-election, and correct this scenario if it's wrong, if I'm running for re-election in a district where they wanted me to vote for this thing, I did that. I voted for it. It is not my fault that
several
the governor
times,
of Georgia decided to veto it. You ought to thank me for standing up for what you believe in. The governor's the guy you ought to be angry at. By the way, the governor's not running for re-election.
Yeah. And if he vetoes it, that will happen. But I do want to point to one thing. I mean, the last two sessions, we have been kind of saved from this legislation by Indiana. Because if you'll remember, I mean, last year it hit Indiana, and Mike Pence, the governor, went on with on ABC's George Stephanopoulos, and just was destroyed when Stephanopoulos kept asking, "Is this discrimination?"
He couldn't answer.
On Wednesday, we might have got another example, another savior.
North Carolina.
Went and overturned a Charlotte ordinance that gave LGBT protections, and also got involved in the bathroom controversy. The legislature came in during a special session, one day session, and rammed through. Not only did they overturn the bathroom provision, but they slapped a statewide ban on all local anti-discrimination ordinances,
preempting all the local.
And Guess who's got a big story in the New York Times today? The state of North Carolina. And it, you know, it their impulse. And let's make sure, Kyle, we say what really what this is. Jim explained it, but let me emphasize it. The North Carolina legislature, by a big margin and very quickly, without any time for debate, said, we don't want cities like Charlotte to have the right to pass their own ordinances that would protect against discrimination of gays and lesbians, transgendered individuals, which is not dissimilar from what the Religious Liberty Bill here was.
No, I'd argue it's very dissimilar.
It's a compromise, the
legislators here were specifically asked to exclude local anti-discrimination ordinances under the bill that was passed. They were specifically asked to include local or protect local non-discrimination ordinances. They chose to do neither, to remain silent. And,
they punted.
Well,
and the speaker, a lawyer, says that the courts are going to have to rule.
Well, yes, and there's a good bit. I'm not a lawyer. He is. But there's a good bit of legal history, track record here, to suggest that these local non-discrimination ordinances do not get overturned by these state laws. North Carolina went ahead and did it legislatively, not through the courts. I'm aware of other local ordinances being overturned by state RFRAs, as these laws are known. In Florida, you had a law about feeding the homeless, and that was overturned. But there are cities in Florida, which is also trying to host Super Bowls and everything else, that have these ordinances. They've had this religious freedom law on the books since 1998. The ordinances have not been overturned. I'm unaware of any instance where that's happened. So I think there's a huge difference, really, between North Carolina did and what Georgia did.
You know what strikes me, and we've all been around the legislative process years and observed this, a lot of sausage is made. You get a piece from this side, you get a piece from that side, nobody's quite happy, and you kind of run the ball down the middle. And that's why they say watching legislation made is not palatable, not pretty.
Yeah.
In this instance, people are refusing to understand that you label yourself, you stamp yourself as non-progressive, pro-discrimination, and you can get in the back room and tweak and make this kind of sausage and more pork and a little less hamburger. You can do all of that, but at the end of the day, what comes out is a bill, another bill, you know, with some discrimination aspects to it. At the end of the day, what comes out is a bill with some discrimination aspects to it, not as many. You've already the daggers already been plunged into the heart.
You know,
and that happened with immigration when they did the anti-immigrant law patterning Arizona. The immigrant community was frightened to death, fled the state, or didn't come for the migrant harvesting, and. So what were the particular lines in the bill were not the point.
Okay, so by the way, you all may have heard what we heard in our earphones. There were obviously some conservative Republicans trying to jam Nan Orrick's signal during that. Brian Robinson, let's take one last take on this thing. You said the governor traditionally likes to relax a little after the session, take some time off. What doesn't he have to get to this immediately, get it behind him? One way or the other? How much more pressure does he want to allow to build? How much more does he want the state of Georgia to be in a national spotlight over this issue?
He could have catfish lobbying him at that lake.
He said expeditiously.
What would you advise him in terms of when to either sign or veto if you were still there?
Well, I wrote some former coworkers yesterday, sort of tongue-in-cheek, and said I would put out an advisory at 12:01 a.m. saying I'm having a news conference at 10 a.m. tomorrow and just get it out of the way.
Yeah. Actually, you know, that happened at 12:30 this morning, right after the legislature kind of adjourned. Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed put out a press release.
Talk about that.
That was actually a very polite one that says I respect my former colleagues in the Capitol, but this is wrong, and I'm opposing HB 757.
Okay, so we'll watch. I'm
you know, I said on this show Wednesday, my bet is that he doesn't go any later than Wednesday without taking action on this thing. But I don't have any money on it, so what's the difference?
Well, and the money is the issue here. If you're going to veto it, every day you wait, just is another another chance for some group to say we're going to cancel our convention or actually do it.
That's right.
I mean, if you're going to veto it, the smart thing to do is go ahead and do it quickly.
Okay, one last quick item on the legislature, and then we're going to take a break and talk a little presidential politics, because how much more delicious can the fight between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz be than it got this week?
I think it's more bitter than delicious.
Well, I'm talking about if you're a tabloid, from a tabloid fan point of view, it's pretty astonishing to watch. But real quick.
Or as a Democrat.
Yeah, right. Or as a Democrat.
Oh, yeah. We having lots of fun.
So the MARTA bill that allows for the city of Atlanta to have a vote on whether to increase their tax by half a penny for $2.5 billion
in sales tax.
Sales
tax.
Yeah.
Right. And this is why Kasim Reed was so polite in disagreeing on HB 757, because they did the city a huge favor. This is the biggest makeover that MARTA's going to have had since its inception, I think.
And it comes after a broader regional bill, Nan Orick, went down. It didn't come out successfully.
That's right. And North Fulton legislator Brandon Beach had the bill that would have the whole county have that on the ballot and would have a half penny allocated to MARTA to building out mass transit.
Meanwhile, those folks up there in North Fulton County get an opportunity. They've decoupled these two measures. They get an opportunity to vote on funding for road projects up there.
Right. Well, you have to go back to last year with the transportation bill, authorized a 1 cent transportation sales tax. And so the argument between North Fulton and the city of Atlanta was, how do we divvy up this penny? And that, you know, if you didn't do transit to a certain level, then you couldn't do the full penny. Yeah. And basically,
and HB 170 gave the city of Atlanta the upper hand in this. Gave them the political upper hand.
Right. And you know, the result was the defeat of the larger bill, because the legislators weren't going to have anything. One thing that the bill last year didn't do was allow them to extend that penny for many years into the future, which you have to have for a major transit investment.
Yeah.
Right. So there had to be some sort of negotiation still, and the legislators had the upper hand before Atlanta would get the upper hand.
Okay, let's do this. By the way, that'll be on the ballot in November. Same day that we vote.
And with billions of dollars potentially to invest, the Beltline, I represent about 3/4 of it in my district, is ecstatic because we're going to have funds there to do build out that is increasing both housing and jobs all around the city.
Okay, we've got to take a break. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, which a lot of people have been doing. I just want to go back from it because TB just sent us a tweet referring to North Carolina, saying, isn't there a middle ground between non-discrimination and having a, quote, dude sharing a public bathroom with my wife or daughter? And that is the sentiment that a lot of people, that the legislature was playing to in its legislation yesterday. So, again, Politics GPB. Let's take a short break and come back and talk presidential politics.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
Beep, 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 yeah.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting and 18-station radio network. You're listening to Political Rewind. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, offering 55 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in more than 250 fields of study.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're heading into the Easter weekend. It's 3:49 on Friday afternoon. With me today, Jim Galloway from the AJC, Kyle Wingfield from the AJC, Brian Robinson, a public affairs expert, guru, used to work with Governor Deal, and Senator Nan Orick, a Democrat from Atlanta. All right, you properly called me out a minute ago. I was flippant in saying the fight between Cruz and Trump was delicious. It's an example of the craven disregard the media has sometimes. And I admit that was very wrong of me. Let's say it a different way. It is awful to see what we have descended into. I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat. This is a race for president of the United States. And now Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are fighting, defending the honor of their wives. Let's listen to Ted Cruz, who really unloaded, and then talk about what this is all about.
I don't get angry often. But you mess with my wife, you mess with my kids, that'll do it every time. Donald, you're a sniveling coward, and leave Heidi the hell alone.
So will you support him as the nominee?
I'm going to beat him for the nomination. He is not. I am answering the question. Donald Trump will not be the nominee.
So, Brian Robinson, this comes because a super PAC supporting Ted Cruz set out a tweeted, I guess, or photographs of Donald Trump's wife back when she was a model posing, I guess, semi-nude.
Oh, new. All new.
Yeah. All new.
All new.
Well, Galloway's obviously looked at the picture.
Jim's ahead
I
of
haven't.
Curve. I know. I tell you what, he's doing his job. He's drilling down.
That's right. So, and essentially their message was, is this what you want in a first lady of the United States? Trump, of course, got into his late night Twitter mode, sent out some nasty tweets, including one that commented on not only Heidi Cruz's appearance, but hinted that she's gone through bouts of depression, right?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if I were Donald Trump, I would have responded to that by going, heck yeah, fellas, that's my wife. That's right. Two, the response to go after Heidi Cruz for having suffered from depression in the past has got to be one of the most Neanderthal, backwards, outrageous things that I have seen in a season of outrageous behavior. To stigmatize a mental illness, to make people feel embarrassed about having these conditions so that they don't go seek treatment when we know what the repercussions
that's
are.
So well, 45 years ago.
It's so 45 years ago. I mean, this is
Thomas Eagleton.
Yes, that's
indeed.
What it is.
Yeah, and it's just, it's outrageous. You know, my wife used to be the disability services ombudsman for the state, and so she dealt day in and day out with people suffering from mental illness, from addiction, and she saw the fallout for these families and for these people who are struggling and all of the challenges that they face, and to politicize something like that is beyond disgusting to me.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this fight, Kyle?
You just continually ask yourself, how much worse can it get with this guy? And then he comes up with an even more despicable answer. You do wonder if we're eventually just going to get back to the point where we bring back duels,
right,
or something. Or,
I mean, well, we had a former governor who longed for that.
I mean, I don't know how. This sort of thing keeps going without, you know, a fist fight breaking out between these two the next time they're together. This is the most intensely personal that these kind of fights get. And in one more rule that Donald Trump has broken is going after each other's family.
It's difficult to make Ted Cruz an empathetic character.
But, isn't it the truth that this happened?
But Donald Trump has managed to make it so. You listen to him standing up for his wife, and you want to stand up and cheer for the guy. Heck yeah, buddy.
Well, let me say something. The polls, the Washington Post had an article today. I mean, the misogyny, the misogynistic outlook, that's long-term, long word for a woman hater. Donald Trump's got a long, long record of mistreating women and talking bad about women and bullying women. And he is losing women voters in droves.
He's got some left?
Well, you know, they're... You could sell some people anything anytime, but this is going into a race where he's going to be up against a woman for
all right. Well,
for president.
He's not the nominee yet. The next big primary, Jim, is April 5th, Wisconsin. That's very big now. And the question becomes, as it always is asked, does any of this have any impact on Donald Trump's ability to win a primary in a state as as Wisconsin?
It's running women off.
And I'll guess we'll see. But look, I mean, in the history of Donald Trump in 2015, 2016, has anything he said hurt him?
I mean, he made fun of POWs.
Yeah.
Well, the right. Post article today does some documenting on that about the women leaving his camp in.
The thing is, he's only 500 delegates short of the nomination right now. Just maybe even a little bit less, maybe 498, and he doesn't have to have that many more wins before it becomes a lock. Or at least he becomes too big to ignore and has to be dealt with.
Yeah, all right. So we're going to be really keeping our eye on how the campaign run going up to Wisconsin. By the way, for you young whippersnappers out there, people like around Kyle's age, Thomas Eagleton was George McGovern's choice for his vice president back in His first choice.
For a brief period of time.
He was a U.S. senator from Missouri, and it came to light, the reason we referred to him in this regard, is came to light that he'd had some treatment for...
Electroshock.
For depression, mm-hmm. for some form of mental illness. McGovern famously said, "I support my nominee 1,000%," and then didn't.
And then dumped him. I think it was for Sergeant Shriver, was it not?
Yeah,
that's right. Very good, very good. Okay, you pass the political
the geezer test. Yes.
Let's talk about the Democrats, Nan Orrick. You're here. You're a Hillary Clinton supporter. Hillary Clinton's on the verge. I mean, how much closer can she get to securing the nomination without having to deal with Bernie Sanders? When does Bernie Sanders finally take his ball and go home? And what are the dangers for Hillary Clinton if he does and she doesn't handle him well?
Well, I expect Hillary to emerge as the victor. I think it's critically important to do everything you can to hold that enthusiasm and the strong support.
So should he stay in?
I'm talking about his voters.
Okay, but she's not got his voters. His young voters are not interested in her.
We shall hope to see that shift.
Okay, well, let's see what happens. But trying to get Bernie Sanders to step out of this race seems to be one of the thorniest issues that is confronting anybody this election cycle.
Yeah, I don't exactly.
Yeah, but if you're Hillary Clinton and you're worried about your young people, mm-hmm. you look at Donald Trump and you say, "Emory University, you're my savior," right there. Those people are going to go to Hillary come what may. Doesn't matter. They're quite frightened of Donald Trump.
All right.
We've had recent news to that effect, right?
All right. We are out of time on today's show. I appreciate all of you being here. And I know that for most of us today, this is a hard day. Our energy isn't at its best because you've been covering this legislative session. And my congratulations to the AJC on doing a terrific job this
session. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Senator Orrick, I know you're tired. You had a long, feisty session battling for your side. Brian Robinson, you must have been very happy that you got to watch this from the sidelines and weren't in the governor's
and
office.
And work in a basketball
day
game or two.
After right. day after day. Who'd you watch last night, Brian? Who's your team in the tournament?
My team lost in the NIT last week.
Well, you know, let us not close out without taking note that we went another session of the Georgia legislature still failing to expand Medicaid.
Okay.
Leaving
Nanora,
the federal dollars
Nanora
on the table.
Gets the last Democratic
but
word.
But getting some rural health care tax credits.
There you go.
Passed.
Good.
We Nonsense. Need
it. All right. We needed that balance. to all of you out there who are getting set for the Easter holiday, my best wishes for a wonderful Easter for you and your family. And thank you, as always, for listening to us here at Political Rewind. You can listen to our shows by downloading our app on iTunes, our podcast, or on our website at gpb.org. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you again next Wednesday for another Political Rewind.